This is the time of the year when you might have to scrape ice off your windshield before taking off in your car or truck, and that could be the least of your vehicular issues. Something bothering your car? Hearing a wobble or a whine where there should be a hum? Our next guest has heard many of these over the years. Zach Edwards is the owner of Ashland Automotive, and he's our partner in a monthly segment we call The Squeaky Wheel. In this context, you are the squeaky wheel. Give us a call or email, speak out loud, to talk about automotive issues you've had or are currently having, either by phone or by email, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Zach joins us by phone this time, directly back from vacation. Zach, thanks for joining us once again on the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, thank you.
So let's talk about some basic issues about cars, because this is something that tends to bedevil the less careful observers, perhaps, and I count myself in this. Preventive maintenance on the kinds of things you should be doing to your car on a regular basis.
Yeah, preventative maintenance is pretty critical with any type of machinery, and cars are no different. Obviously, we've talked before on the show about regular oil changes for the engine and the transmission. Also, the engine coolant, otherwise known as antifreeze, needs to be changed periodically every couple of years. So those three things are pretty quintessential. And then any other fluids in the powertrain as well.
And what about the things where the mechanics are always saying, well, you had to get your 10,000-mile checkup coming, your 30,000, your 50,000, your 90,000, et cetera. There are different things I notice in each of those.
Yeah, so those are mostly, a lot of times they're inspections of various components, and you might, or your listeners might have been told by various other people that, oh, you don't need that, or that's not necessary, but they actually, the visual inspections can prove very, very useful in discovering problems before they become major problems, and if the technician performing the inspections does it carefully and thoroughly, they can be very, very valuable to the driver.
What made me think about this is I've been looking at my list of generic questions, and one of them is about the timing belt getting changed. I mean, that's one that I had changed out at 90,000 miles once, and it wasn't done terribly well, but that's a different story. What goes on in the timing belt, and how, I mean, people actually crack open the front of the engine then and get a look at this thing?
Well, the timing belt inspection, oftentimes, if the vehicle calls for that, there's generally an inspection window, and that would be a little cover that you can remove to be able to put tension on the belt to feel if the tension is correct or if it's loosened up. And if it's loosened up, of course, you would need to remove more components to tighten the belt. But the visual inspection of the belt generally wouldn't do any good, because you're looking at the back side of the belt, and where you really want to be inspecting would be on the underside of the belt. It's a toothed belt, much like modern motorcycle belts use, and so the inspection window doesn't really give access to that, so it's more of an inspection of the tension of the belt.
And then when how often should that be replaced on a car?
Well, every car is different. It used to be 60,000 miles, and then they extended it to 90,000 miles. And nowadays, timing belts generally are called to be replaced at about 110, somewhere around there. Again, every vehicle is different, but every 10 to 12 years or every 110,000 miles is a general rule of thumb.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the question of, is the engine an interference engine or not? So when they ask about, or when they speak about interference engines, they're speaking about the piston syncopation with the engine valves. And that's really what the timing belt does, is it keeps those two components in time so that they don't collide. And in an interference engine, you can have a catastrophic collision if those two components become out of alignment or out of syncopation. And then, of course, the driver's having to basically buy a new engine. And so that's why it is very, very critical on an interference engine to do the timing belt replacement at the recommended time.
How do you know if you have an interference engine or not?
Well, your shop should tell you, and they should say, you know, anytime a consumer is trying to weigh the benefits of doing a repair, you know, they're going to be asking questions like, you know, what risk am I taking if I don't do this timing belt? And of course, the shop should say, well, this is a non-interference engine, so if your timing belt breaks or slips time, you're going to be broke down on the side of the road, but you won't you won't be damaging your engine. Or the alternative is, you know, if the timing belt slips time, you're risking catastrophic engine damage, and it's going to cost thousands of dollars to repair. And so any shop should be able to advise the customer on whether or not that particular engine in that particular car is that application.
We are talking to Zach Edwards once again in our monthly segment, The Squeaky Wheel. What's been going on with your car or truck? Or can you think of some things that have happened in the past that just bedeviled you and the person who fixes your car? Maybe you're the person who fixes your car. Let's hear your stories. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Does the timing belt take the place of something that used to be there, some separate component that used to be there on older cars?
Well, there's a, you know, the timing belt or the timing chain. And so a lot of new cars are using a timing chain. Mm-hmm. And in the old days, and I say old days, like, which is, you know, that's a totally relative term, but
right. About 20 years different for us.
Yeah. In a lot of older Chevy and Ford applications, they use the timing chain. And then a lot of the Asian cars, when they came into being sold in America, they were using timing belts. And the benefit of the timing belt versus the timing chain is that the belt doesn't need to be in a bath of oil. Mm-hmm. Timing chains have to be submersed in oil. And so the cover for the chain is really prone to leakage and other things. So the belt, it was a much cleaner and I wouldn't say reliable, because the chain actually lasts longer than a belt. But the belt was, in a lot of ways, it was the preferred method of timing the valves and the piston for a lot of manufacturers for about 30 years. Mm-hmm. And now what we've seen is a lot of cars have gone back to a chain. And that has to do with variable valve timing, and which is a more complicated engineering method that they're using to squeeze more out of less. Mm-hmm. So they're getting more power out of smaller engines. And I think a lot has to do with going to the timing chain, and then they use a really cool engineered gear. It's a cogged gear that allows them to vary that valve syncopation timing with the piston based on engine demand. And it's a huge innovation, and it's very, very reliant on engine oil being clean, which now goes back to that preventative maintenance. You know, if you get your engine oil very dirty and sludged by not changing it, these variable valve timing systems can become really screwed up because they're relying on hydraulic pressure from engine oil. So back to your original question, the chain is really starting to come back, and is in, I would say, half the applications out there now are running chains again. So, and again, the chain is really, it's a lifetime of service. They don't ever really call for the chain to be replaced, but that doesn't mean that they don't need to be replaced when there's a mechanical failure.
Okay. So, all right. I have some questions about oil as well, but I want to bring in a question here from Mike in Medford, who writes, my front wheel drive car has been making a clunking or clicking sound when I turn the wheel all the way left or right. I changed the outer CV joints, but it still makes the noise. Any suggestions would be great. And thanks from Mike in Medford.
That's a good one, Mike. The first thing that came to my mind was outer CV joints. So those are CV stands for constant velocity. And it's basically that joint is like it's like your wrist. If you're moving your hand round and round, you know, that allows your wheel to go round and round, forward or backward, up and down, and in and out, left and right. And so what's inside that joint is, I think, five really big, they're about the size of a pinball, steel balls. And so if you changed that, I'm not sure if you changed the entire joint or if you just changed the boot. So the real question is, and is Mike still on the line, Jeff?
No, he wrote this in, so he's not, it's not
okay.
A phone call, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, there's a couple things that happen. There's a boot on the outside of this joint, and inside that boot, the joint is packed with grease, and it's a real heavy-duty grease. And so what happens is the boot usually rips. This is the first phase of failure, is the boot rips. And then as the it's on the axle, which is turning the wheel from the transmission. That joint is mounted on that axle. And so as it's going round and round and you're going 70 miles an hour down the freeway, the boot cracks and the grease gets slung out of that joint. And at that point, those five pinballs inside there start to chew up the race, which is the housing that the balls sit in. And because they're not being lubricated properly by the grease, they kind of chew up that housing. And then you get a contamination not only from inside the joint with a bunch of metal fragments as those balls chew up their housing, but you also get outside contamination from driving down the road, and you've got, you know, gravel or cinder if you're going over the mountain pass. And so if somebody is going to go in and change that joint, it's a pretty difficult job. I mean, my technicians, it's not uncommon for them to get stuck on one and have it take a lot longer than they think, because it's just hard to take them apart. It's really, really messy. You've got to clean and inspect everything very, very carefully. And if there's any damage done inside that joint, every component needs to be replaced, which is why we oftentimes just replace the entire axle with both new joints, because it's fairly cost effective to just replace the entire thing. But so, Mike, if you're still listening, hopefully you clean the joint really, really well, put in all new grease, and inspected and made sure there was no damage before you put that new boot on there. But I would say you still have a problem with the outer CV joint. And in the process of whatever you did, I'm not sure if you nailed it the first time. You might need to go back in there and do it again.
Does it make a difference if you're hearing the clunking at the lower speeds rather than higher ones? I only hear it, for example, in my car when I'm backing up slowly.
Well, it sounded like, I think you had said, Mike said he heard it when he was turning left or right.
Yeah, way left or way right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that tells me it's almost certainly it's going to be an outer CV joint. I mean, it could be something else. But now in your case, Jeff, you're probably, if you're only hearing it in reverse, that would lead me to want to inspect your transmission.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so there's gears. You probably have a manual transmission.
No, it's automatic.
Oh, okay.
But, I mean, I am turning to get into the driveway, so that's why I think it might be from the steering stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so when you're turning and in reverse.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that could definitely be an outer CV joint. It depends on which direction you're turning to. So generally, if you're turning right, it would be, and this is just generally speaking, mm-hmm. These things, there's no real science to this. If you're turning right, it's generally the outer left joint, which is the first one we would suspect. And if you're turning left, it would be the outer right.
Okay, so the opposite one.
Yeah, the weight of the vehicle kind of shifts. So when you're turning left, the weight of the vehicle kind of shifts to the right and puts a little bit more stress on that outer joint on the opposite side of which you're turning.
Zach Edwards is our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange. The segment is called The Squeaky Wheel. In this context, you're the squeaky wheel. Give us a call. Talk about what's going on with your automotive issues, car, truck, or what have you. 800-838-3760 to describe the problems under the hood or outside the car. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You were talking about oil and the need to change that, which we've established at generally 3,000 miles. I don't think I've ever asked much about the difference between the oils that come from the earth and the synthetic ones, if you have any particular feeling about the value of the synthetic oils and where they might be best used.
Yeah, so synthetic oils, and in a lot of newer applications, it's really critical to use oil which has been approved or is the correct rating for which the manufacturer is calling for. So your owner's manual would tell you, you know, when you change your oil, use only this kind of oil approved by this manufacturing specification. And so a lot of times that's a crude-based oil, and a lot of times that's a synthetic oil. And so the synthetic oils are really just laboratory-made, and they're generally a little bit thinner. So if you have, for instance, say if you have a couple of oil leaks, you have an older car, we've got a couple of slight oil leaks. Those leaks might actually be made worse by using a synthetic oil versus just the traditional crude oil.
Mm-hmm.
But we generally just put in the oil in which the manufacturer calls for, because nowadays, as I just mentioned, it's like so, it's so specific and scientific, the lubrication, and it has to do with also clearances inside the engine. So when they build these engines now, which last so long, and one of the reasons the engines last so long is that they have very, very tight clearances in, say, the crankshaft and the bearings that support the crankshaft, where those tolerances used to be measured in thousandths of an inch. Now they're measured in 10,000ths of an inch.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, you know, those basically, if you think about that amount of space, a 10,000ths of an inch, the two components are basically touching each other and spinning at, you know, 2,000 revolutions per minute. And the only thing in between them is a thin film of oil. And so that's where the viscosity of that oil becomes very, very important, whether it's a, you know, a 1040 or a 1030 or a 530. And nowadays, a lot of the modern Subarus that we're working on, they take a 0W20. So it's a zero weight, which is very, very thin. And of course, if you put in a 10 weight in that engine instead of a zero weight, there's a chance that oil is not going to find its way into those slight, very, very microscopic spaces, and then there's not going to be lubrication in there, and damage is going to result.
How much difference between, say, a 10W30 and a 10W40? Because I remember I had a car once that the manufacturer's spec was 10W30, and then the mechanic said, oh, I put 1040, and it's a little thicker at the warm end. It's like, yeah, it's not what the manufacturer said, though.
Yeah, so with an older car, it becomes less important, I think, because those spaces that we're talking about have increased because of the age of the vehicle. And so and this is where we're now in a non-scientific realm talking, because I don't know how
we're not down to 10,000ths of an inch anymore.
Right. And of course, those older vehicles never had those types of tolerances to begin with. Their spaces were, or their specifications when the engines were manufactured, were far greater than, than anything of modern technology. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you have a high mileage vehicle that's also an older vehicle, it's you're probably not going to really do any damage, and you're probably going to be actually pretty safe to put in a little thicker weight oil. And the reason people do that, and the reason your mechanic might suggest that, is that, you know, if you have an oil consumption problem, meaning your car is taking a quart of oil every 1,000 miles, it might only consume a half a quart of oil every 1,000 miles if you run a little bit thicker oil. Or your leak, some people might think their leak is reduced. They don't leak as much oil if they run a little thicker oil. So, you know, going from a 1030 to a 1040 in an older vehicle might not be a bad idea.
All right, just some general stuff on when you start feeling wobbles in the car. I've heard different stories from different people. If you feel it in your hands, it's one thing. If you feel it in your seat, it's a different thing. I mean, if you're feeling those kinds of wobbles as you drive, particularly over certain speeds, what are those likely to be, Zach?
Oh, that's a tough one, Jeff. We read tech articles all the time about diagnosing suspension and steering problems,
mm-hmm.
and they can baffle even the best technicians out there. So, if you're a technician and you're trying to determine what's going on with the car, you really just have to take it down the road. Oftentimes we take cars down one of the worst roads in town, which is Middle Clay Street. I don't know if you know that street, but it's...
Between Highway 66 and Siskiyou Boulevard?
Exactly, yes. I guess that street falls in between city jurisdiction and county, so nobody maintains it. And it's just got about the most number of potholes we've ever experienced, and then patchwork. And so it's great for diagnosing steering and suspension noises. And we just kind of creep up and down that road, and you can hear all sorts of noises. And, the technician really just kind of has to go based on what his experience has taught him, what he knows is happening under there. And then go back to the shop and, you know, run a couple of tests, get out. Oftentimes they'll use a really long pry bar, you know, like a 4 or 5 foot pry bar, to try and simulate the forces of the road, on some of these joints, which are connected with bushings. You know, the suspension system on a vehicle is really a lot of linkage that's made to be flexible so that the forces of the road don't get transferred into the cabin area and to the driver. That's what allows you to drive down a bumpy road and be relatively comfortable. But they could be really, really difficult to determine, you know, what's going on. And when we think about what these cars do for us, you know, how many miles we get out of them without these things just completely breaking and falling apart, it's pretty incredible. So oftentimes, you know, the car needs everything replaced. and of course, we can't just do that because we're on a budget for the customer. And
right.
we have to determine exactly what is making that noise when in truth, you know, probably the whole entire suspension system could handle a revamping.
All right.
But it's just cost prohibitive to do that. So it can be pretty tough.
All right. We'll pick it up with you next month and have some more mysteries to solve about the noises and squeaks in our car. Zach Edwards is the owner of Ashland Automotive and our regular guest for once a month segment called The Squeaky Wheel. Zach, good to talk to you again.